Blog Talk Radio.
This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, August 22nd, day number 223 of 2014. Tonight we're going to catch up with our friend Barry Jacobson. We're going to talk about World War I. This is our third chapter in a series of programs about the war that started 100 years ago this month. Tonight we'll be talking about the United States, President Wilson and the United States. We'll be talking about Russia. And we'll be talking about lots of other stuff in between as the United States enters World War I at this time back in 1916, let's say. I think that was the right time, 1516, something like that. So we'll be getting into that with Barry tonight as we continue our series of programs about World War I. We're going to do a show, by the way, at the very end of the series where we sort of look at the aftermath and how the map of the world changed, which is remarkable when you think about that. If you're looking for an audio book, if you're the type of person that likes to hear the book rather than read it, or if you're busy, if you have a sales job, a lot of you are in sales, you're in your car, you're driving around, and you enjoy listening to audio books, whether it's a self-development type of book or a business book or just a plain fun mystery or romance. If you enjoy doing that, we're going to ask you to check out audible.com. There is a link on the show information to audible.com. Click on that and check out their inventory. I mean, they've got an incredible inventory of audiobooks. As I say, anything you like, from romance to mystery, whatever you like. So check it out. And if you get a book, hey, I'm not going to let you're going to make my day if you get a book. So. Check out audible.com. We're going to take a break, and we've got Barry right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, and let's say hello to our friend Barry Jacobson. How are you, Barry?
I am as well as any member of the petite bourgeois can expect to be on a summer day.
There you go. I like that. I like that attitude. You have a bourgeois attitude, right?
And we're going to be talking about the communist revolution today in Russia, so bourgeois is a good term to use. We are still bourgeois here in America.
That's right. It fits in. Very well. I saw a cartoon recently of Fidel Castro and a bunch of other of the world socialists, and they say they talk like Marx, but they live like a capitalist. And that is so true of many of these left-wing leaders who love to talk about socialism, but they're in their private life, they lead a good life, Barry.
Well, you know, the roots of Marxism and the whole philosophy dates back to Plato and his Republic. And, you know, that was the very beginning of that sort of utopian notion. And Plato identified clearly the leaders of that sort of utopia needed to be philosophers, virtually saints, because it's just against human nature to live like busy worker bees selflessly, you know, in the service of the state. So you never see that because it's just against human nature.
That's right. You're right about that. Well, you know, our friend Leslie sent me a note today for On This Day in History, and I wanted to go ahead and report on that. And again, thanks, Leslie, for bringing this to my attention. But this happened in 1911, so I guess about 3 or 4 years before the war was started. But there is a connection to World War One, which I think is very interesting. But I'm sure all of you know the painting Mona Lisa, not the song by Nat King Cole, but the painting Mona Lisa. And it turns out that in 1911, a fellow by the name of Vincenzo Perugia stole the painting. And, in fact, it was missing for a couple of years. They finally found him. They put this man in prison for 7 months. And then later he was a veteran of World War One with the Italian army. So there's your connection to the war, Barry. Mona Lisa stolen by a World War One veteran of the Italian army. I don't know what else he did during the war. I'm sure he served with distinction. But there's your connection to the war. Now, you've got a good, you've got an on this day in history as well.
Well, before I get into that, let me just say I still prefer the Nat King Cole song
well,
to the painting.
Well, it's cheaper.
You know, it
I mean, you can get a copy of Mona Lisa by Nat King Cole for 99 cents. You can download it for 99 cents. But if you want to get yourself a copy of the portrait, well, you better write a bigger check.
Yeah, you know, and she's always considered a great beauty, but I look at Mona Lisa, the painting, and she just looks like a woman is just smiling politely at a bad joke.
Yeah, I never.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the essence of the painting is the look in her face. I guess. I mean, she's not necessarily a pretty woman. She's just a woman with that look. I guess that many of us have gotten at some point in our lives.
That's right. When the women in our life puts up with a story we've told for the 30th time to guests, and she has to smile politely, it's that sort of look.
For me, it's an extra inning baseball game in the West Coast when it's 1 o'clock in the morning and the game is still on.
And your wife wants you to come to bed.
Yeah, or at least turn off the TV. That look, you know, of how long is this thing going to last, you know?
Yeah,
don't you know we have to wake up tomorrow?
It's got sort of a tight, polite smile, you know, with no humor in it.
That's right. That's right. So go ahead. Tell me about your on this day in history.
Yeah, my day in history, the 22nd, is this is the anniversary of the Battle of Bosworth Field. And why that's significant is because it ended the War of the Roses. The War of the Roses being a dynastic war, in other words, a war fought within the dynasty that had ruled England throughout most of the Middle Ages, that being the Plantagenet dynasty, and two houses, the House of Lancaster and the House of York, each had took a rose as their symbol, white rose for York, red rose for Lancaster. And the last battle was fought on this day, and it ended with the death of the English king, Richard III. And the audience might remember him as Shakespeare's villain of the play by that name. He's depicted in the play as being a hunchback with a withered arm and a schemer and a scoundrel who steals the throne from his nephew, who's only 12 years old. But interesting enough, it's not only an interesting battle, but Richard's body was buried and then lost in history after the battle, only to be recovered in 2012. They found it underneath a underneath the parking plaza in the city of Leicester. And when examined, it turned out he's not a hunchback. He did not have a withered arm, though his back was twisted a bit with scoliosis, so he probably had a slightly raised left or right shoulder. Can't recall which side. But he died valiantly fighting in the Battle of Bosworth Field against Henry Tudor, and Henry Tudor won the battle. He became King Henry VII. And he ushered in the Tudor dynasty, of which Queen Elizabeth was his granddaughter.
This is the lady who is the queen right now, right?
No, this is Elizabeth I, the one who defeated the Spanish Armada.
Oh, okay.
Patron of William Shakespeare.
So I'm about like 500 years. I'm about 500 years wrong. My Elizabeth is about 500 years off, but.
Well, I thought your false. I didn't give you the date. The date was 1483. So yeah, you're off by a couple centuries.
I'm off by a little bit, as they say. Well, the War of the Roses always been fascinated by that name. I know we did a show on that with Leslie a while back, but I've always been fascinated by that name. You don't think of roses as something you want to use for war. So it's just an interesting interesting title for a war, I guess.
It was a fascinating war, and we, you know, anybody who's interested in it can go to my my blog page, which
yes.
you have, I believe, listed.
Yeah, I have
and
a
I've
link
got
to
a,
it, yeah.
new and I got a new post on the War of the Roses, Battle of Bosworth Field.
That's right. We have a link to your blog in the show information right there underneath my my pretty face. My smiling face, which sometimes. I don't know. There it is. There it is. My Mona Lisa face that I have for the audience. But we're going to be talking tonight about World War One. We're going to talk about the United States and Russia, as I indicated. But I think that the question. Let's get this going tonight with a simple question. What was so unique about this war? There have been many wars before, but this one was unique, Barry. And maybe you can explain that to us as we begin the show tonight.
Well, I think you have to say that what makes World War One so unique was it was truly the first modern war. It was a war that saw aircraft being used in war for the first time, including the bombing of cities, strategic bombing of cities, something that would come to its fruition during World War Two, but it began in World War One. You have weapons of mass destruction being introduced for the first time, with poisonous gas being unleashed on the battlefield on a large scale, mostly mustard and chlorine gas. You have battle tanks. You have machine guns. You have barbed wire. You have trenches. You have a war that began with, and you have submarine warfare for the first time, where submarines become the thing, attacking merchant ships. So you have a war that began with cavalry charges and bayonet attacks, basically tactics that hadn't evolved a great deal since. Say Napoleon, and the war ends with the rise of communism, of course the United States as a great power finally on the world stage, and all the weapons I just told you about, so that warfare will never be the same, and of course the geopolitics of the world will never be the same.
Yeah, I was thinking, we were talking off the air, we're going to do a show at the end of the series, we're going to do a show about how the war changed the map and how we know the world today. But it is amazing to me, if somebody had gone to sleep, let's say you had for some reason fallen asleep in 1913 and then woke up in 1919 and you were reading about the world or you were reading about the weapons, it must have been, it must have been transforming, almost as incredible for someone like you and I to think that 25 years ago, most of us didn't have a cell phone or an email or a computer. We certainly couldn't do a show like this 25 years ago on the Internet. So those kinds of changes, happened in World War One. It just changed the world as people knew it. And maybe that's why the war was so frustrating, because maybe they didn't understand how lethal these weapons would be until they started seeing the casualties, Barry.
Yes, and there was a sense throughout the war that led to collapses on many fronts. The French army mutinied in 1917. The Russian army mutinied and led to the revolution that overthrew the Tsar. The Italian army collapsed, and Italy actually changed sides at one point. And it was all out of a sense of frustration that was from top to bottom. I think some of the generals had a sense of optimism that was completely misplaced, but the common soldier saw intimately that everything they were doing was fruitless and was simply stacking up the body count. And it wasn't until the very end that there finally became a solution, and we'll get to that, of course, at a later installment when we get to the end of the war. But it was terribly frustrating. It was as though you came out to play checkers and suddenly you were facing a chess master playing chess. It would be that insoluble and that hopeless.
Yeah, well, you're right, and that's what makes the war, frustrating. I'm sure to some of the people back then, because as I say, most of the veterans of previous wars in 1914 would have been veterans maybe of the U.S. Civil War, if there were any around. There may have been some around 50 years later, But no one had seen what you're going to be describing tonight, you know, the kind of weapons and the kind of damage that, you know, you talked about last week in some of these battles where there was like 600,000 men, you know, lost in one battle. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, we are in an age of what we call casualty averse, where if America loses 20 men in a battle, we're just astonished and angry. We're going to talk about battles today where a million men were lost. You know, we went into Iraq with less men and conquered the nation of Iraq with less troops than by a factor of probably 1,000 than have fought in a single battle of this war. I mean, the numbers have never been equaled. Even World War II, even though it was a much larger war in some sense, did not involve the staggering numbers that were involved in World War I, which we'll get to in just a minute. It was just a whole different sort of thing. And by the way, speaking of Civil War generals, you're very right. General Leonard Wood was with Teddy Roosevelt as part of a movement trying to get us into the war. And he was a Civil War general, Leonard Wood. Still around in 1917.
Well, because it was almost 50 years, right? Because the war ended in 1865, and this is, what, 1913, 1914, that time frame. So these men, the generals would have been probably men, I'm guessing, in their 80s by now, maybe late 80s. So there were probably very few of them left. Maybe some soldiers left. Life expectancy was obviously less back then. But you had the only other war that America had fought was the Spanish-American War. That was obviously not a very long or complicated war. So even the American public probably wasn't ready for some of the images and some of the casualty levels that would be coming home for them. So why don't we get started tonight? Where would you like to start?
Let's start with the opening of 1916. We left off with 1915. So the next year, 1917, opened with the Central Powers being basically Germany, Austria-Hungary, and originally Italy, and then they switched sides. These were called the Central Powers, and they were against the Allies, which was France, Russia, now Italy. They had switched sides. Now the Italians had joined them, and then Great Britain. These are the Allied Powers. The year opened with the Central and Allied Powers approximately equal strength. But Germany was much better organized and didn't have the problem of disunity of command that the French and the British had on the Western Front. And the biggest thing you're seeing by 1916 is that the manpower drain is becoming significant. Casualties have really been adding up. And Britain had always had a professional army that was voluntary, small but highly trained and voluntary, and that dated back all the way to the 17th century, after the time of Oliver Cromwell. And now for the first time, they were having to introduce compulsory service, a draft. And as we talked about at the very close of yesterday's show, or last week's show, the battles were decimating their population, and really the best part of it. When you think of who goes off to war, it's always the best. It's not your worst. The men who go off are physically fit, whereas the ones who stay home are not. And that would have a significant effect on European manpower in the coming years. So in the beginning of 1916, there was a big reversal in Germany. The German general staff changed leadership. And a guy named Erich von Falkenhayn became the German chief of staff. And he basically convinced the Kaiser that instead of the defensive strategy on the Western Front, that had allowed the Allies to basically dash themselves against the trench lines that had been, you know, Germans have been fairly successful at that in previous year, that basically they could win the war by a battle of attrition and bleed France white. And he was going to take advantage of a French trait, which was a French called elan, which was this notion that you could throw yourself at the enemy with a bayonet, and with enough courage, enough elan, these charges would succeed. And the French took a very long time to get over that notion that you could triumph against machine guns using, bayonet charges. So Falkenhayn chose a target which was going to be a magnet that draw the French to it and create basically a slaughter ground, like a killing field. that would have no purpose except to get the French to keep throwing manpower into it. And he chose as his location a city that was sacred to France, that they would have to defend. And that town was Verdun. In February of 1916, the Germans launched a massive offensive against Verdun with the idea of drawing the French into a battle of attrition. And the German strategy was fairly clever. It was to basically take ground initially and then simply hold it on the defensive, because the defensive was where all the advantages were in this age of machine guns, and force the French to keep attacking them to drive them out of the city. And this could give you an idea of the scope. In the initial attack, the Germans had 1,400 artillery pieces bombarding Verdun, and a million men of the German Fifth Army attacking. And that's in just one small city. That's a tiny dot on the map. A battle line extending from the English Channel to the Swiss Alps. In the course of battle, over 40 million shells would be fired into Verdun. 40 million artillery shells. I think they're still actually picking out artillery shells to this day. It turned the entire landscape into this nightmare of shattered buildings, where the building collapsed into its basement, and then we're fighting in the basements. And as the rains came, the dirt turned to mud, of course. And hundreds of thousands of unburied bodies. And you can imagine the stench of this battle. And this went on for quite a long time, from February till December. Almost the entire year, 1916, was taken up with the Battle of Verdun. Ultimately, it failed in that France did not break. They were blood white, virtually. The following year, there'd be a mutiny in the French army against similar kinds of battles where the soldiers just wouldn't do it anymore. But the French, strangely enough, in one of those weird occurrences the war sometimes sees, the French actually got more stubborn and more determined. And the watchword at Verdun became, "They shall not pass. They shall not pass." It was the saying that the Germans would not pass the French defenders and take the city of Verdun. But it became applied to the entire war effort by the French, that Germans would not conquer France. Now, interesting enough, that same year, the British were planning their own offensive that was postponed temporarily because of the crisis at Verdun, but which, by the way, is in Champagne, region of France, in the eastern part. But in Flanders, where the British were, there had been a plan by General Joffre and General Haig to launch their own offensive, and that was called the Battle of the Somme River. And this would be, if anything, even bloodier and even more of a failure. And this was going to be the bloodiest battle in human history, with the possible exception of one that took place in China in the 19th century, the Taiping Rebellion. But in any case, the First Battle of Somme begins in June, a few months after Verdun has been in the way, over in Flanders. And the Allies attack with a massive attack, including tanks for the first time in battle. The British have this new invention called the tank. By the way, it's called the tank because that was a code name for a land cruiser. It was designed with a cooperation of the Navy to create basically a land ship, a land battleship, and was designed essentially very similar to a naval cruiser, but using tractor treads. The tractor was a fairly new thing in those days. And Winston Churchill, who was first Lord of the Admiralty, had a hand in the king of this project, the idea that we'd break the stalemate with these armored behemoths. Much bigger,
Barry,
slower than what you said later.
One quick question, please. Just to put in my own mind, to settle a curiosity, you know, a tank today, I think everybody's familiar with how big it is. I mean, it's this huge machine that can do so many things, as we saw during the Gulf War, especially during the Gulf War. Compared to a tank today, I mean, how big were the ones before? I mean, half as big? Or obviously, they couldn't do as much as the ones today, but I mean, in terms of just the physical size of it.
Bigger than some of the ones in World War II, and probably comparable, and depending which version, because there are many versions of tanks built during World War II. Some were larger than the modern tanks, both taller and broader and longer.
Really?
And some were somewhat... Yeah, some were small. There were three or four man tanks. There were some tanks that had a crew of 6 to 8 men.
And
they were fairly
from a military standpoint, the beauty of a tank is that you can bring power pretty close to the enemy, right? You can get close to the enemy and protect, obviously, the men inside, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about the landscape, we're talking about a flat landscape with almost no cover, no trees, mm-hmm. no bushes. It's been devastated by a year and a half of war. It's pockmarked with shell pockmarks, kind of like the map of the moon, and strung in front of either set of trench lines, the British and French on one side, the Germans on the other, is this no man's land between these lines of trenches. And, of course, the trench lines are defended by various lines of barbed wire you have to get through, and then there's pillboxes or battle positions with machine guns every 100 or 200 yards defending the trench lines. So the tactics up until 1916 were basically to get up in a rush, usually preceded by an artillery barrage, sometimes lasting for days. The Battle of the Somme begins with artillery barrage the last four, 7 days. And then under the cover of artillery, you rush forward from your trench line. They called it going over the top. The men would literally go over the top of the lip of the trench in mass, bayonets fixed, each man shoulder to shoulder. And tens of thousands of men would rush forward across this no man's land. And, of course, they'd be subjected to artillery dropping among them, and nothing an artilleryman loves better than infantry in the open, a perfect target for an artillery burst. So thousands would die from the artillery, and even thousands more would die from the machine guns that would just cut them down like an invisible sword or scythe cutting wheat. And sometimes they'd be gassed as well. So it was just there was this inability to cross no man's land. So the tank would give you this armored moving fortress, essentially, the size of your living room, that would give you not only physical cover to walk behind so the machine guns couldn't hit you because you're behind a steel, behemoth, but it could hit those trench lines of barbed wire, crush the barbed wire. It'd be impervious to the machine guns. Only a direct hit from an artillery piece could knock it out, and generally that would not happen. Artillery was not that accurate. And then when it reached the enemy trench line, it was armed with cannons and machine guns to blow up pillboxes or sweep the trench line with machine gun. Plus, they were built in such a way they actually could cross the trenches. They were very big and very broad for a reason. They had to cross a trench line that might be 12 feet wide.
Speaking of tanks for a second, Barry, it just reminds me of that movie Saving Private Ryan, when they have that scene in that small town where they're defending that small town, and this big German tank comes in, that's the image of tanks, I guess, that I have. But anyway, let's get back to the story. I have to ask you about the tanks, because they're such a such an amazing, like the workhorse, I guess, of modern warfare, huh?
And the way they changed base over time was the World War I tanks were very slow. They basically were the speed of a man walking. And they were armed with fairly small cannons. I mean, so small, they smaller than anything was used in World War II. They usually had several machine gun turrets, not just one or two, but five, six, or seven. And the improvement in tanks up until World War II and then afterwards was the tanks got faster, a little bit smaller because it made a smaller target for the most part. And their cannon got more and more powerful, and they only had one of them. Instead of multiple small guns, they'd have one big one. So that's the main difference in tanks. Tanks eventually got faster, and infantry had to keep up with the tanks rather than the tank keep up with the infantry. And that was the big change in World War II with the advent of the Panzer Division. But that's another story. So getting back to 1916, and basically you had the Battle of Verdun early in the year, and then further up the line in Flanders Field, the British launched the Battle of the Somme. And again, they used tanks for the first time to lead this attack, but it was premature use of tanks. They weren't perfected yet, and while the British gained ground, they gained about 8 miles deep into the German lines. All total, about 125 square miles were captured. It was at enormous cost. The battle ended with the Allies, the British losing 420,000 men, 58,000 in one day, the largest loss of British life in the history of the British Empire. The French lost 195,000, so for total Allied loss of over 500,000. And the Germans lost another 650,000, mostly in the counterattacks that drove the British back at the end of the battle, which lasted till November. So 1916 has two enormously costly battles, the Somme and the Battle of Verdun, with nothing gained, absolutely nothing gained. Meanwhile, there's, you know, the war goes on in other places. And most interesting enough, the only naval battle that took place, and in fact the only naval battle that pitted battleships against each other in the history of warfare, was the Battle of Jutland, which takes place that same year. And let me just give you a little background on the what was going on at sea. The British began the war with a huge naval advantage over Germany. The Kaiser had built this fleet that was the second best in the world. But as I cautioned America about our military, there's nothing more worthless than having the second best military. Particularly if you have to fight the first best. And that was the British. The British were lords of the sea. Their army was tiny, but their navy was enormous. And particularly they had a huge advantage in battleships. They had about 28 to the German 13. And the battleship was a new thing. It had only been built for the first time with HMS Dreadnought being the first one ever. And in fact, Dreadnought was the name the battleships were called during World War I. They're called Dreadnoughts. But HMS Dreadnought, the very first one, comes online in 1905. And then there was this race to build as many of these behemoths as you could. And the British had more. So when the war breaks out, the Germans don't have enough to go out and fight. They just have enough to take up an enormous amount of resources maintaining without any real chance to use them. Until the Battle of Jutland. And that was the Germans' one chance to try to break out of their confinement at Kiel, their base, which is the base of the base of the Jutland Peninsula. And the naval battle breaks out, which the British high sea fleet, I'm sorry, the British Grand Fleet meets the German high sea fleet. And it ends in a stalemate, but one of the things that's interesting about the battle is the British had built these battle cruisers as a second-rate ship that was faster than a battleship, had almost battleship guns. But the way they obtained the speed was to break down the armor, take as much armor off as they could. And this is the day when, you know, ships relied on steel plates, sometimes 6 inches thick, along their sides to protect them from these massive naval guns, which fire shells the size of trash cans. And at the Battle of Jutland, the British battle cruisers were tested for the first time, and they really weren't designed for this. They were designed with a much more mobile battle in mind, where the British battle cruiser would be out in the high seas chasing down enemy cruisers, where it would have a gun advantage, and it could use its speed to gain maneuver room. But at Jutland, it was a slugging match, and shells coming in from the enemy battleships proved to go right through their thin armor and blow them right up. And the British lost a number of these battle cruisers. Admiral Jellicoe, watching from his flagship, the Iron Duke, just said, something is damn wrong with our ships. And they blew up one after another. Despite the loss of the battle cruisers, the Germans actually lost the battle. The British actually won it. And Germany didn't try again to go out to sea. But in any case, the summer of 1916 saw the only battleship battle in the history of warfare, where battleships were the main capital ship in the battle. By World War II, the aircraft carrier will have become the main ship of the line, if you will, the main battleship. And the battleship itself will become something used for shore bombardment. So Jutland is fairly unique in that respect.
Yeah. I just think when, again, you know, going back to the point you made before about the level of casualties here and how, you know, today, you know, we talk about, and again, every life is important. I don't mean to make a life sound just like another number. But when you think of 4,400 men in Iraq about that much now, I guess already in Afghanistan. It's just unbelievable when you think of these casualties. The question I have for you, and maybe this question applies more to the American public when you take us into the part about the American involvement, but how much information about this level of casualties, how much information did the public have? Were the public aware of these deadly totals, or was it just like, well, you know, my son's coming home dead and there's another kid down the street who's dead also? I mean, maybe they kind of put it together that way. But some of the public had to know, you would think, of how bad it was, Barry.
They did. And the newspapers in most of the countries would print every day the casualty lists that were given out by the military, including names. So unlike today where you were usually the first one to find out your child has been killed and you'll get a call from the commanding officer, in World War One, the first time you found out that you had lost a loved one was when you went to the newspaper and opened up and saw his name. Unless he was an officer, and particularly a prominent officer, in which case you might get a call from his commanding officer or a telegram, more likely. Telephone was still a fairly new thing. And that led to widespread disaffection with the war fairly quickly. The Battle of the Somme was called the Slaughter of the Innocents by the British press. And it led to the fall of the British government. The prime minister actually resigned and was replaced by Lloyd George, who had served throughout the war from then on. And it led to a cry by the public, which the military mostly heeded, to stop these ridiculously costly offensives. But, of course, there was no answer other than the offensive to try to win the war. So they had to find some other solution, which eventually would come along. But not till somewhat later. The one place they probably were in total ignorance was in Russia. Russia did not have a real free press, and there was little communication between the front and the people back in Russia, back in the rear, except returning wounded veterans who would tell usually how bad it was. The Tsar was putting out lots of rosy stories about how things were going. But that was not the truth at all. The Russians were losing an enormous amount of people and getting absolutely nowhere. And the Tsar and his staff were incompetent, which was the reason why. And this would lead by the end of the year to the Russian Revolution, which we'll get to in just a minute. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, it's just fascinating to me when you have numbers of this magnitude. I mean, look, if we had numbers like that today, it would be so politically devastating for whoever happened to be in office that it would be politically. I don't know how you would survive politically. Look at Vietnam. Look at Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam. And that was 60,000 soldiers.
Well, that was 60,000 by the end of the war. I think during Johnson's time, it was maybe half that.
Half of that, yeah.
Three quarters that.
But it was the weekly count that, if you remember during Vietnam, with Vietnam, it was, 100 a week. Sometimes, you take 60,000 over, let's say, roughly a 10-year span, 5,000 a year, that's about 100 a week. But there were weeks, of course, obviously, when we had more than 100. I mean, some weeks where it was 200, 300. And, I can remember being in high school back then, and somebody would talk about, somebody's friend, was killed in Vietnam, that kind of thing. I mean, that was very common.
Yeah, in World War One, that would have been how many casualties you took during the Christmas truce when you weren't supposed to be fighting at all.
Right, amazing.
Moving on, let's go to the Middle East. The Middle East, the map of the Middle East would change during World War One dramatically. And in fact, the Middle East as we know it today would be more or less born during that war or what followed. The war began in 1914 with the Turks, the Ottoman Turks. An ancient empire that dated back to the 16th century, ruling all the Middle East, and really from basically Libya across North Africa, including Egypt, all of Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and parts of Iran were all the Ottoman Empire. And, of course, in Europe, they extended up to the border of Bulgaria. And this Turkish Empire was the sick man of Europe. It had been for many, many years, really close to a century. It had been declining. And the British took advantage of that, and they invaded first Persia and Mesopotamia, which was the old name for Iraq. They were stopped by the Turks there. In fact, they had quite a defeat. The Turks assisted by the Germans. And that would be the way all throughout the war. The Turks would have German advisors. In fact, Falkenhayn, the guy who was the brain, whose brainchild was the Battle of Verdun, Erich von Falkenhayn, was fired after Verdun, replaced by Ludendorff and Hindenburg. And he went to the Turkish front and became the advisor to the Turks. And the British answer to that was to put an army into Egypt, which had long been occupied by British troops anyway, as when they were allies of the Turks. And now they, of course, were enemies, so they just simply took the country over. And the lions were basically fighting the Turks in what's modern-day Gaza. The battle lines were right around Gaza and extending into the Sinai Desert. And the Turks held Palestine, and the British were having a very tough time pushing through past the Gaza line, the battle line of Gaza, with their base at Cairo. And their commander was a guy by the name of Allenby, who had fought at the Battle of the Somme. He was quite talented, and it was really a great stroke of genius to put him down there because he came up with some novel solutions. And one of those was to form up a revolt in the rear of the Turkish lines by the Arabs. Now, the Arabs have been long dormant, and they didn't like the Turks, but they were disunited. They were kind of a tribal people. The House of Saud was beginning to rise up in the desert as a power. And then there was a very large sort of counter group that was centered around Mecca, the House of Faisal. And the British sent an emissary to Faisal and tried to get him to fight against the Turks. And he wasn't terribly interested until the British eventually sent a young officer who was enormously charismatic. And his name was T.E. Lawrence, Thomas Edward Lawrence, known to posterity as Lawrence of Arabia. And Lawrence was one of those desert-loving British men who, for whatever reason, just loved the desert, loved the Arabs. He wore these flowing white, Arab robes. He spoke Arabic perfectly. He understood the mind of the Bedouin. He understood they weren't soldiers and would never be soldiers, but they could be terrific guerrilla fighters. And with camels and horses, they were able to navigate in the desert in a way that the modern armies couldn't. The Turks were basically stuck to operating along the coast using the railways that they had built. And Lawrence took advantage of that by building a Bedouin army and attacking the Turkish supply lines and blowing up their railroad lines, which were their main supply source. And he won a terrific victory at Aqaba, where coming out of the desert, completely unexpected, in 1916, he captured Aqaba, the Turkish port that guarded the approaches to the Gulf of Aqaba and the Sinai Peninsula. And all their guns were naval guns facing to the sea, expecting the British to attack out of the Red Sea, of course, British naval ships. So all their guns were pointed out to sea, and he came from behind out of the desert, where they had no defenses. And so that was the Great Arab Revolt, it was called, begins in 1916. And we'll talk more about that later because it really becomes a really huge deal in 1918 at the end of the war when the Arabs have become a power because of Lawrence and are demanding to have a place at the peace table. So that's what's happening in Mesopotamia. So now let's go to the real meat of the discussion, which is America. Because America was sort of an awakening giant. The Kaiser had tried very, very hard to not get America involved. And in fact, America, for the most part, didn't want to get involved. There were some elites who were dead set against it. The common, American didn't give it much thought, and when he did think about it, didn't think it was our business to be fighting Europe's wars, particularly this one where there really was no cause. There was no this wasn't the Nazis, where you could see good versus evil. And this was basically a dynastic squabble between the royal houses of Europe. However, that changed in 1915 when a luxury passenger liner called the Lusitania was sunk by a German U-boat. These are submarines, and again, submarines become a weapon of war for the first time during World War I. The German submarine was called the U-boat, underwater boat. And it was a fairly primitive thing. It wasn't like the U-boats or the submarines of today. It was a ship that had to surface every few hours to ventilate because the engines gave off toxic gases, the diesel engines. But it could cruise for a very long range on the surface. It cruised for 7,000 miles on the surface before it had to refuel. So it allowed the German U-boats to spread clear to the Indian Ocean, where they were sinking Allied shipping. In fact, the greatest danger the Allies had of losing World War I was because of U-boats. The Germans were sinking such tonnage, millions of tons of Allied freighters, that Britain very nearly was on the verge of starvation by 1917, because of Germany's unrestricted U-boat policy. And that policy, by the way, means that it used to be you had to be a ship that was flagged under the nation you were fighting to attack it. In other words, the Germans could say that we're within our rights to sink a British ship. And furthermore, it was one of their rights that the ship was carrying munitions. But the unrestricted policy said if any ship of any nation was carrying supplies to Britain, it could be sunk by a U-boat. And that's why the Lusitania was sunk. And when the Lusitania went down, it had 124 Americans on board. And this led to a year of wrangling with the Germans, in which the Kaiser first apologized and backed off, but then by the following year, by the middle of 1916, the Germans went back to unlimited unlimited submarine warfare. I mentioned bombing because, by the way, at the same time, the Germans also increased the number of bombing of British cities. We think of the Blitz, the Blitz of World War II, where Hitler bombed London. But actually, the first Blitz was by the Germans in World War I when they launched these giant Zeppelins, of all things. You think of the Goodyear blimp. Think of the Goodyear blimp on steroids. And these were these giant Zeppelins, and these were the bombers of the day. And Germany in 1916 actually launched, from January till December, hundreds of raids by these Zeppelins until eventually the British got their act together and with air defense were able to shoot these things down. So that became the first bombing of civilian targets. But getting back to America, Woodrow Wilson didn't want to get in the war at first. In fact, he campaigned against it. His campaign was basically that 1914 was he kept us out of the war. But by 1915, the pressure was on, led by Teddy Roosevelt, the former president, to basically we had to get involved. We had to get involved in this war. It was a world war that was not just a matter of national pride, but the stakes would be too high for whoever won this. And America had to have a place at that table, the victor's table. And with the Germans sinking American, killing Americans at sea, it became the tide sort of American opinion came against the Germans. And Germans were always portrayed as the Huns by the British press, and this filtered over to America. So we started thinking of them in the same terms as the real bad guys in this war. Now, I have to say the Germans didn't start the war, and the Germans were probably not much worse than anyone else in the war. They were a little more brutal in Belgium than was standard of the day, but not by much. And they certainly weren't the Huns of Attila. But that's the way they were portrayed. They were portrayed as basically rapacious, destructive, and they had to be stopped. But that was just propaganda. But America started to buy into it after Lusitania. So finally, there was one last catalyst that brought America into the war, and it was called the Zimmerman Note. Are you familiar with that?
No, not that one. Refresh my memory. I think I am, but refresh my memory.
Well, it was a cable that was intercepted and by the British and then sent to the Americans. And it was a note from the German ambassador, German Foreign Secretary Alfred Zimmerman, and it was supposedly sent to the president of Mexico. And basically the whole idea was that Mexico would join Germany and Germany would help Mexico in a war against the United States. Mm. Mexico would get out of it, the return of Texas, California, New Mexico, and Arizona, the Southwest territories.
Mm-hmm.
And Germany would get America so involved in its own backyard that it couldn't get involved in Europe. Now, no one knows to this day whether that was a plan that ever would have come into fruition. It was a secret and very preliminary negotiation, but it was leaked to America, and that was the final straw.
Right. Yeah, you have to wonder. Yeah, you have to wonder, though, going back then, I mean, what kind of shape Mexico was in to begin with. They had just gone through their own revolution. They had just had basically a civil war in Mexico, and they were probably in no shape to fight any kind of a war outside of Mexico. As I said, their civil war, their revolution had been very devastating. So even if they had wanted to do it, I'm not sure they would have been a lot of help to the Germans, you know?
Well, this is the era of Pancho Villa, who was
operating
in the north, Zapata in the south. Of course, Zapata was dead by this point,
right?
I believe. But Pancho Villa had just recently, the year before, actually this year, 1916, he actually crossed the border and raided into the United States. And an American Expeditionary Force led by a guy named John Pershing, who was nicknamed Blackjack Pershing because he commanded black American troops earlier in his career. He had chased Pancho Villa down into Mexico to try to bring him to justice, and he didn't catch Pancho Villa, but one of his young lieutenants was a cavalry officer that recently graduated from West Point. And this young man was quite an athlete. He had competed in the 1912 Olympics in what was called the Equestrian Pentathlon, military pentathlon, which was, I don't know if they still do it, but it was military games that officers of those days, were expected to be proficient at. It was horseback riding. It was rifle shooting, pistol shooting, saber fencing, the kind of military arts of the 19th century. And this young man had gotten fourth place. He just barely missed the bronze medal, so he was very good. And this young man went with Pershing down to Mexico, and his name was George S. Patton, Jr.
Another name,
Another name that would come up very prominently later in American history.
Many times,
Patton was a fascinating character. He was a master swordsman, a master shooter, and had this, and a very, very tall man, a natural athlete, and he was a cavalryman, and he rode with Pershing down against Pancho Villa, and they never caught Villa, but a great and fascinating incident took place. Patton had walked into a bar in his khaki uniform. He's down in Mexico, and he was confronted by two of Pancho Villa's lieutenants who were drinking in the bar. And in true Clint Eastwood style, there was actually a gunfight in which Patton shot down both of Pancho Villa's lieutenants.
Sounds like a Western.
He really was the real deal. Patton was the ultimate American cavalryman. He was the Western hero. So World War One comes along, and America has had enough, and by 1917, the Zimmerman note in March comes to mind. And so the following month, in April, on April 6th, the United States declared war against Germany. It followed quickly by Austro-Hungary. 8 months later, we declared war on Austro-Hungary as well.
Mm-hmm.
But Germany, within a month of the Zimmerman declaration, and John Pershing was given command of what was going to be the American Expeditionary Force. We didn't really have an army, a standing army at the time. We had cadres, but we needed to build an army. It would take us another year before we actually get troops over there. A million Americans would arrive overseas in May of 1918, which we'll talk about next time.
Right.
But they brought along the Selective Service Act. The draft law was the first time America since the Civil War had a draft law. We'd only been drafting troops once before, and that was from 1863 to 1865 during the Civil War. But the draft, as you and I think of it, the one that you and I had to both sign up for during the Vietnam days, came to being that year because of the need to fill up this American Expeditionary Force.
Right. And, of course, President Wilson, just to get a couple of dates, he was elected in 1912, and then in 1916, when he ran for re-election, the war was already going on. So he was running in 16 as a wartime president. But both times, interesting thing, a little detail about Woodrow Wilson, he was elected and re-elected in a three-way race. So he never got 50% of the popular vote or anywhere close to that. He was like 42, 43 in that range when he won. Primarily because of Theodore Roosevelt running in 1912 divided the Republican Party. And in 1916, there was a similar type of situation, but I don't remember who the Republican was. But interesting. Woodrow Wilson was a very controversial president. You know, I mean, some people really hate him. Other people really love him. He was one of those political figures who, you know, there was nothing neutral about him, Barry. You loved him or you hated him.
What's really interesting is that he, as you said, he campaigned against the war.
Right.
In both his elections, and actually in his second one, because the war didn't start until 1914, in the middle of his first term. And then so 1916 comes along, and he wins that by saying he kept us out of war. And then he's inaugurated in January, and then by April we're in war. We declare
That's
war
right.
in April. So
That's
three,
right.
three, what, 3 or 4 months later?
Well, I think, it, you know, we talked a little bit about this the other time, about the same thing could be happening to Barack Obama after these midterm elections, you know. Because I do believe we're, you know, changing topic for a second here. I do believe we are headed to Iraq War number 3 in the next 6 to 9 months. I think we're headed in that direction or some type of a conflict. And it could very well be President Obama who takes us there after having basically been an anti-war president. But those things happen. As someone said, you know, you can choose to run for president, but you cannot choose the events that you will face as president. Woodrow Wilson, obviously, probably the last thing in the world that he wanted to do was to be a war president. But we're going to continue next week, Barry, with Chapter 4. We'll probably get more into Russia, I would assume, the next time, and more into the United States. And now the war is at a stage, I guess, where it's really starting. It happens in every war, where it really starts to wear, you know, on public opinion, and people are getting tired of the war. I mean, that's probably where we are right now as we conclude our show tonight.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, we're at a point by the end of 1916 where all sides are exhausted, but there's no end in sight. And I think, you know, a good war is a war that lasts, like the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, you know, about 100 hours. You know,
right.
It's one glorious battle, and then it's pretty much over. At most 2 years, and then the public becomes fairly war-weary. And in the case of the current war, after 10 years, we're not just weary. Americans are just bored.
Right.
They're tired of reading about it.
Well, also, another big difference with the current war, Iraq or Afghanistan, is that it's a volunteer army fighting. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a volunteer army. My son is a member of that army. But I just think that when you have a drafted army, you're touching more households. You got more kids.
You are.
You know, because you're basically, you know, every kid has a chance of going. Whereas now, I mean, I'll just give you one last example. My son graduated, our number 3 son in the U.S. Army graduated in a class of about 500 kids, senior kids. And maybe 10 are wearing uniform. So, I mean, that kind of gives you an idea. If we had a draft, that wouldn't be the case.
It's a double-edged sword. I almost make mixed metaphors there, but
yeah, right.
It's a double-edged sword in that when you have an all-volunteer military, you have less social unrest when the military is used because, as you said, less people are involved, less households are involved. But you also have less skin in the game,
right?
Which is a problem when a nation
which is what I think.
War,
yeah, go ahead. We're just about out of time. Yeah, go ahead and finish that thought. We're just about out of time.
All right. When a nation goes to war, I think the nation needs to vote with its feet, and people should decide to support the war or not by joining the military. But a draft is given that option. A draft basically forces them whether they want to or not. Notice that the anti-war movement of the 60s died out almost instantly as soon as the draft was done away with.
Right.
When the college kids didn't have to worry about going to war anymore, they stopped being interested in going out and demonstrating.
Right. No, you're right about that. There's no question that a draft involves a lot more people. Well, Barry, we'll have to continue Chapter 4 the next time. We have a lot more to get into. I don't know how many chapters we're going to do, but we'll do as many as it takes as we look back to the 100th anniversary of World War I. But we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we'll pick it up the next time.
Well, as always, it's my pleasure, and looking forward to talking with you next time.
Let's do it. Let's do it.
And hopefully we'll get through 19 up to 1918 by the next installment.
I think so. And we'll get into Russia, which has always been a fascinating curiosity of mine, the czars and all of that. Thank you, Barry. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, have a good day.
All right. Barry Jacobson, our friend, military historian. He's got a blog as well. We have a link to the blog and the show information. We're out of time, my friends. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later. This is Silvio Cantu in Dallas.